Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. This is the show where we talk about our values. Namely, what are the political and ethical values we hold, and how might we update their definitions for the times we live in? I'm Alice Thwaite, the founder and editor of the Echo Chamber Club, and with me today is Matthew D'Ancona, celebrated British columnist, currently writing weekly for The Guardian on current affairs. He was the editor of The Spectator from 2006 to 2009, and he's also contributed significantly to The Telegraph, GQ and The Evening Standard. He's also an author, and his latest book is coming out in May called Post-Truth, The New War on Truth and How to Fight Back. And here he is with us today to talk more broadly about the values he holds and what he makes of the overarching political events of the day. Welcome, Matthew.
Very nice to be here. Thank you, Alice.
Wonderful. So let's get straight into it and start talking more broadly about your values. So how do you characterise your political beliefs?
Well, I start off, I suppose, from a pluralist position because I'm a Londoner. I've pretty much always been a Londoner. And as my surname suggests, my father's a Maltese, but the name is originally Italian. So, I'm of immigrant stock, and I, align myself very strongly with the view that the world, not just in this particular city, but the world generally, is becoming more pluralist, is becoming more diverse, and in a sense, the challenge that lies ahead of everyone is to work out what that means and how to negotiate the challenges that it implies, and that's a personal and a principled belief. That's my kind of starting point.
Okay. So if we just talk about that notion of pluralism a bit more generally, because a lot of people have different interpretations of what pluralism might mean.
Yes.
Have you noticed it changing in definition over the last 5 to 10 years? What does it mean for you today?
Well, I think that at the heart of pluralism is what political philosophers call incommensurable values, which is the idea that at some point, individuals and communities will rub up against each other with differing views of what's right and what's proper. And the challenge for individuals and groups is to both live their lives, and this can be in terms of gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, faith, whatever, but much harder to agree on a set of norms which are non-negotiable. And obviously, that's the key question, and it's there isn't a definitive answer to it, but it's got to include the obligation to obey the law, the obligation to pay your taxes, and then it gets really interesting, because is there an obligation, for example, to speak the majority language of the country you live in? And I think in the last probably the last decade, it's become a bit more robust as a demand. Not just as a demand either, but also as an idea that people are unable to get the full value of citizenship unless they are able to speak English. So I think that's something that's become very interesting. Another area where, which is really in its infancy, but it's clearly going to be a massive issue in the next 10 to 20 years, is the whole issue of trans and transgender issues. I think this is going to be one of the things that really defines the politics and the political philosophy of the next 20 years. Because, I've heard of workplaces now where people are saying, where's the bathroom for transgender people? Now, so it's becoming a practical issue as well as one that's discussed in the abstract. So on all these fronts, the question is not, should we be diverse, or should we return to some imagined nativist monocultural society that probably never existed? But how do we negotiate the challenges of living in a society that's going to, if anything, become more diverse.
So that's interesting that you brought up transgender issues there. And I'd encourage our listeners to listen to a podcast we did previously with Beck Stinson, who was the head of trans inclusion at Stonewall, as a bit of a side note. Why do you think that something like transgender politics is going to be more of a concern compared to the gap in between people's values in cities and rural areas, or perhaps the rise in kind of interpretation of extremist views and how we view immigrants? What is it about transgender issues that's...
I don't think it necessarily will be a bigger issue because it's very interesting that you raise the whole question of the gap between urban and rural values, which I think is one that's underexplored. And certainly for reasons that are obvious, the question of how we deal with extremist ideologies is ever present and has to be dealt with as sort of priority number one, really. But I think the thing that, about trans issues that's interesting is that in a way, pluralism is a process that never ends. It's not just a condition. I think that what's happening with the whole question of trans identity is that people are becoming much more, and this is a welcome thing, much more open about discussing their trans identity. And this is a shock to the system, the overall system, because as presently framed, our institutions and our culture is not geared, it's not designed to cope with this. And so what we're seeing is yet another iteration of what has happened in all sorts of cases. They're never the same. The issue of ethnicity and race has been much, much, much more potent and much more aggressive in some instances in some societies. The whole question of gay equality is still live, and trans issues will have their own shape and will have their own discourse. But I found it fascinating because I think it's just we are in the absolute foothills of dealing with this. It's intriguing to me that you're now seeing, for example, a genuine split in the feminist movement over how to deal with this. You know, Germaine Greer platformed what constitutes female identity, and really core issues like that being suddenly interrogated by another identity group. So I think that is something I wouldn't for a minute pretend to have even the right questions, let alone the right answers. But I do think you can just tell by the way it's beginning to, as an issue, to sort of poke its head above the parapet everywhere. And that suggests to me that it's indicative of something to do with identity generally, which is fluidity and whether people are in future decades going to identify themselves perhaps quite so rigidly according to preordained categories. I suppose that would be my very, very first draft take on what this might mean for the shape of society 30 years down the line.
That's interesting that you just brought up identity, because that was actually going to be my next question, is how does pluralism work when it comes to your identity? Do you think that people not necessarily choose identities now, but they're definitely more fluid identities now compared to before, when perhaps you took on the identity of your parents? How do you think that your political values cope with, not cope, but align themselves with the idea of identity politics, and whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think that we are, I can only speak for myself, really. We are more inclined now, we're more free than we were as a society in the 50s to express ourselves and identify ourselves with whatever sexual inclination, with whatever way of life we want to. But I also think that we sometimes probably delude ourselves about the extent of that freedom. I mean, as I get older, the more I realize that I'm very much the product of my parents, and the way they brought me up. And that's not to say I've not had any free will in my life, and I own my mistakes and the things that I've got wrong. But at the same time, I think that I wouldn't quite say biology is destiny, but certainly upbringing does a lot to define destiny. And I think that our identities are not perhaps quite as a la carte, if you like, as we particularly in metropolitan circles tend to claim.
Okay, that's interesting, because that deviates quite a lot from, I'd say, you know, the individualist movement and perhaps what a lot of people of my generation think about their identity as well. But I'd like to speak about something different, actually, Matthew. So we were both at Names Not Numbers recently a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And you spoke about a new politics of 2017 requiring a new renewed sense of citizenship. And I'd just like to explore that idea a little bit more. What does citizenship mean for you above and beyond perhaps all speaking the same language? What does it mean to be part of a community?
Well, I mean, let me approach this in a sort of a slightly pathological way and say what's gone wrong with citizenship, and then maybe we can unpack what it actually should be.
That sounds good.
I mean, I think the first thing that's happened is that in the last century, there was an absolutely necessary and entirely welcome growth of the state to ensure that there were standards of decency and well-being for all. And this created a gigantic expansion in the role of government in our lives. And that has been by far and overwhelmingly a good thing. The downside, however, has been what I would call a partial infantilization of people, which is that their instinct now is to say, what are they, a never-defined they, going to do about a particular problem? And I think we've lost that voluntarist spirit, if you like, to do things ourselves. I generalize massively, of course, because there are huge numbers of volunteers and there are huge numbers of people who contribute a massive amount. But generally speaking, that idea of the state has become very dominant, and I think it has had a corrosive effect upon the notion of citizenship. The second thing, which I would broadly identify with right of center politics, has been the reduction of citizenship to consumerism, which is, if you like, that in the 80s and then followed by New Labour, there was this whole idea that citizens were consumers of public services, that they were customers and that they should be treated as such. And again, this tended to hollow out the idea that if you take an institution like the NHS or local schools, these were civic institutions, and encouraged the idea that they were businesses and we were their customers and we were entitled to treat GPs and head teachers as if they were executives in charge of the, or CEOs in charge of the businesses. And there is some merit in this. It encourages efficiency, and contracting out has certainly had some good effects. But the downside, again, is it drains from citizenship the notion of a community that has something in it that's not just to do with transactions. So that's my kind of, that's what I think has gone wrong, obviously speaking. On the other hand, if we're honest about those problems, and we don't attempt what I'd call a restorationist project, which is this disastrous impulse there is on some parts of the hard right to kind of resurrect what they imagine life was like in the 1950s. I'm actually fairly sure it wasn't like what they imagined, but, you know, this sort of nativist people cycling through rural landscapes, no non-whites. It's a ghastly thing, really, and I'm sure completely and utterly unlike what it was like living in what were were very difficult days of considerable privation. So I think there's an opportunity now to recast citizenship. And I think it goes back to what I was saying about the non-negotiable core. Louise Casey's review recently on integration was very interesting because it was really about how to reach people in disenfranchised communities and people who did not feel part of the society in which they were, of which they were members. And she was quite tough on local politicians and also on the general unwillingness of people, by which I suppose she meant the media and civic figures and so on, to cause offence. Her point, I think, and I'm paraphrasing and I hope I'm not misrepresenting her, was that there are times when you have to say, these are the values of this society, and you know, this is the way that a British citizen has to behave. So classically, and I've had some interesting and generally quite civil Twitter exchanges with practicing Muslims about this. The whole question of gender equality in Islam, I think, is a massive issue. The point made to me by Muslims is, some Muslims, I mean, they speak for themselves, not for the entire faith, is, look, you know, it's a matter of religious freedom how women behave, and you have no right to criticize that. Well, I'm sorry, but I do. And I also think that female equality, gender equality, trumps, if you like, any religious claims to the contrary. Now, that is a statement of priority. I mean, that makes me puts me in a position where I'm saying one value matters more than another. But I think that's the serrated edge of this discussion, where you have to sometimes say, in fact, you know, we understand what you're saying, but unfortunately, this is more important, and therefore, I think it's entirely legitimate in the whole issue of faith schools, for example, to insist that female pupils at Muslim schools are given a education that prepares them for a life of equality, for full job opportunities, access to higher education, and all that sort of thing. And totally aware that these are not easy conversations to have, and it's very important that they be conducted in a civil and respectful fashion. But it is really important that we don't start off from the proposition that we must never, ever, ever, ever cause offence to anyone, because everyone takes offence at something. And if you start on the basis that not giving offence is your sort of key and overriding objective, you absolutely will not achieve anything.
So there's a lot of interesting questions that have been raised there, but my first one is around the practicality of creating these non-negotiable values, for example, and you've spoken about potentially gender equality being trumping religious freedom. How might these conversations take place in a community, especially one that is large as a whole country? How do you think we can reach these non-negotiables, and also how frequently should those non-negotiables be reviewed?
Well, I think that the worst way to go about it is to try and draw up a list of British values. And I say that as someone who's sort of tried in the past, because you always end up with a series of commonplaces, you know, freedom, equality, decency, justice. I mean, frankly, which democratic society would not aspire to those things? I actually think that the way to do something is almost always found in praxis, which is not to kind of set out with a grand charter of rights and responsibilities, which several senior politicians have considered doing, but to approach each problem as it arises. So, for example, you know, if you have an education bill and it's going to affect free schools or schools generally, you make sure that there's a clause in there about the way in which female pupils are treated. That's just to give you an example. And it's debated in the House of Commons, and people and the Lords and other, and every, as in any process, there's a white paper first or even a green paper, and there is a process of consultation and a media discussion, and that's the way to go about it. Not to kind of start off with a set of abstractions, because that has never really been the way this country works. And it's a fascinating distinction between the British and the American systems, I think, is that in America, the Constitution is, in a secular sense, sacred. And it almost to the point where it has become an impediment to progress. And the kind of veneration of the Second Amendment has made it impossible to have a sensible discussion about gun control. In this country, if anything, we have the opposite problem, which is that setting aside Magna Carta, which really isn't the kind of liberal document it's sometimes claimed to be. It's full of very obscure provisions. We don't have a basic set of we don't have a document that sets out our way of life and our fundamental expectations. We have an accretion of these things, some written, some not. And I actually like that, because I think that British society, like all societies, is going through seismic change. And this century is going to be one of even greater change, and that we need to be nimble and agile. And therefore, what we're discussing now will seem fantastically outdated in 10 years' time. To take an example, not wanting to go off on a tangent, but people at the moment are incredibly exercised by immigration. It has become the absolute sort of focal point of political discourse. It's my belief that this is one of the great red herrings of politics in the last 50 years, in that immigration, I'm unfashionably in favor of it. I'm positively in favor of it. I think it enriches society. I think it's an economic necessity. And I think post-Brexit, it will continue at more or less the rates that it already is. I think that decision was taken a long time ago. The real transformative force is going to be automation. The thing that is going to cause tremendous changes to the way we live is the fact that so many jobs, and not just, if you like, low-skilled jobs, but also white-collar jobs, are going to be performed by robots, by algorithms, by artificial intelligence in quite short order. And no one has figured out how to cope with this.
Matthew, I was going to actually, because this is going to be another question, because you spoke before about what's going wrong with the community, so the partial infantilization of people.
Yes.
So, and a big, a major discussion point about this automation problem is universal basic income.
Yes.
Which causes a heavy reliance on government. So what do you think of that as a solution? I'm sorry to interrupt you there. It's just I was thinking when you were talking about it.
It's a perfectly reasonable question. Well, what is for certain is that one byproduct of automation, not necessarily in the short term, but certainly in the medium to long term, will be a re-expansion of the role of government. It's been fashionable since the 80s to talk about rolling back the frontiers of the state, even though, in fact, the state has continued to be quite a large factor in our lives. But that's been the sort of idea that somehow, you know, the state should withdraw slightly. I think automation will necessitate some form of greater intrusion in daily life. Now, that may take the form of a basic income. There are pilots being done. I think there's one in Glasgow at the moment and parts of Finland, I think. The problem is, though, that with that data is it's largely connected with the use of the basic income as, if you like, an alternative to a complex system of benefits, rather than as a means of giving people some money because there are all the jobs they used to do were performed by robots. Now, in his book, The Rise of the Robots, Martin Ford argues very, very cogently for basic income as a way of dealing with that. My suspicion is that he's half right in the sense that there'll have to be some form of state-led provision of to fill the gap left by the departure of labor to machines. But I'm not sure it'll just be about money. I think it'll be about activity. I think that, that one of the biggest tasks facing government in, let's say, 2050 will be the provision of things for people to do, because we'll be an island of 70, 80 million. And I think that a large number of those people will not actually have anything particularly significant, or at least in terms of what we would call a normal job to do or to perform, or the likelihood of it. Now, we are so talking about the issue of identity. You know, my generation, I'm 49, and you know, certainly previous generations were brought up very much to think that what they did was a large part of what they were. And I think that that presents an almost existential problem, because in a world of automation, in a world where algorithms do what, you know, a lot of professionals now do, we're not just talking about robots that can stack shelves. We're talking about robots that can provide basic legal services and accounting and so on. What people do and how they spend their time will become the social question. I must say that worries me a lot more than the debate about immigration, because my sense talking to people in Whitehall and Westminster is that there is comparatively little deep thinking going on about this. If you look at the fringes, it figures in the government's industrial strategy. Yes, there are one or two think tanks doing something about it. The think tank of which I'm proud to be the chair, Bright Blue, is publishing its new magazine on automation quite soon and robots. So there are things being done at that level, but what is not being done is a kind of blue skies or grey skies strategy to prepare for this, because what will happen, as always happens in technological revolutions, is there will be a step jump which happens very, very quickly, as there was with broadband in, I guess we're talking the first few years of the century. Suddenly, the internet technology went from being dial-up to broadband and everything changed. The world changed in not quite a heartbeat, but certainly in a year or two. And I think that the automation will be the same, that it will suddenly become the case that it is so much cheaper to do almost everything algorithmically that jobs will disappear at a rate that seems inconceivable now. Now, this may sound very apocalyptic, and of course, there is a counter-argument, which is that people will always require a need face-to-face contact with people in a certain number of contexts, classically in healthcare, perhaps even in financial services, who knows. But the fact is that huge numbers of jobs are going to disappear, and we're not remotely prepared for that. And that will be the, I think, the major problem for the next generation. Will be how do they spend the hours that they are not working, which may be many.
So on that happy note of us contemplating a lifetime of leisure and what we'll do with it, because the Echo Chamber Club doesn't just do a podcast, we also do a weekly newsletter that tries to challenge people's normal perspectives and challenge their point of view. What would you recommend our listeners to read in their leisure time that might challenge their perspective? What has been a book or an author or a podcast or anything that you'd recommend?
It's funny you should mention podcasts, actually, because one of the things I argue in the book about post-truth is that I call podcasts the punk Socratic dialogues of our time. I think they're really good, and I think that people should hoover them up because they're replacing the role that, as it were, the old media used to play, and to a certain extent, human conversation face-to-face used to play in just interrogating ideas and making them a bit more comprehensible. So that's my first sort of point. On the question of what I've been reading, I do think that the various books that are coming out about automation are fascinating. I mean, Rise of the Robots by Martin Ford is now in paperback. Homo Deus by the same guy who wrote Sapiens. Harari.
Yeah.
Is excellent. And there's a cheerier book by Thomas Davenport and Julia Kirby, that's right, called Only Humans Need Apply, which takes a slightly rosier look at the world of automation and says that, in fact, if human beings enhance their skill sets and work in tandem with machines, they will be able to survive this coming storm. So I, you know, that's just three books. There are many others, but that would be a kind of good starting point, I'd say.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
My
and
pleasure.
Engaging in a new type of human conversation. I'll put all those recommendations as well as some of the studies that you mentioned on the Echo Chamber Club website. So check that out if you're listening to us on iTunes. If you'd like to have some links to the stuff that Matthew's been talking about. Thanks to Matthew Dankena for chatting with me on Skype today. Quick one for all of you. If you like the Echo Chamber Club podcast, then please do give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. It really does help us get more visibility and raises awareness with people just like you who might like it too. Or you could just tell your friends. That would also help. To let you know, the Echo Chamber Club offers a weekly newsletter aimed at liberals, progressives, and metropolitans to help them access different points of view. And recent newsletters have defended pro-life feminism, shown exactly how the Saudi Arabian media is reporting being sued by the 9/11 victims, which is interesting, and also a Brazilian think tank's view on democracy. So you can sign up via the website at echochamber.club to get all those newsletters. And to let you know, please email me at any time with any thoughts that you might have. My email address is editor@echochamber.club. Until next time.